Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI.
Mm.
Welcome to the deep dive. Now, when most people hear the name Rachel Carson, they immediately think of Silent Spring.
Right.
Right? That monumental book that really sparked the modern environmental movement.
Absolutely. It casts such a long shadow. But today, we're actually going back further. Way back.
We are. We're going to the very beginning of her published work, her debut from 1941, Under the Sea Wind.
And this book, it's foundational. It often gets overlooked because it wasn't, you know, overtly activist. It wasn't a call to arms in the same way.
So what was its mission then?
Its mission was quieter, but maybe just as revolutionary in its own way. It was really a pioneering piece of narrative nonfiction.
Okay.
Trying to do something quite radical for the time. Present the ocean not as a resource, not as a collection of data points, but as a living, breathing world, full of its own drama, its own beauty, entirely separate from us humans.
And it established her unique voice, didn't it? This was the first book in her famous Sea Trilogy.
That's right. And you can see it laying the philosophical and maybe even the emotional groundwork for everything that followed, including Silent Spring.
So it wasn't about telling people what to think?
No, not yet. It was more about teaching people how to feel the ocean, how to perceive its reality on its own terms.
Right. And that's really our goal for you listening today. We want to help you gain this intimate, almost empathetic understanding of what it's like to live a life totally governed by the sea's ancient rhythms.
Yeah, forcing us, ideally, to step outside our very human-centric viewpoint for a while.
Okay, so before we dive into the book itself, let's talk about Carson. Who was she? What made her qualified to write this?
Well, Rachel Louise Carson, born 1907, died in 64. She was, especially for her time, unusually qualified. She held a master's degree in zoology from Johns Hopkins.
That's serious scientific training. So how did she avoid just writing, you know, a dry academic text, which you might expect from someone with that background?
That's the fascinating part. It comes down to her professional life, I think. She spent 15 years working for the government, first the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries, which then became the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay. Doing what exactly?
Her job essentially was to be a translator. She took complex scientific field data, you know, biology, migrations, population dynamics, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And she had to turn it into material the public could understand. Things like radio scripts, informational brochures.
Ah, so she wasn't just a scientist or a writer.
Mm-hmm.
She was professionally both right from the start.
Exactly. She had this rare combination, the rigorous mind of a trained marine biologist who deeply understood the science and the skills of a genuinely gifted writer who could weave that knowledge into prose that was, well, compelling, evocative even.
So when Under the Sea Wind came out in 1941, it really put her on the map as a nature writer, long before the Silent Spring controversy.
Absolutely. It established her reputation, and you can already see her core perspective forming. She saw nature not as a collection of resources for us to exploit,
right,
but as this intricate, interconnected community, something deserving of respect, of careful observation.
Okay, so let's get into the book itself. The central idea is pretty ingenious, isn't it? It's framed as a biography of the sea.
Yeah, and crucially, it's told entirely through the lives of three specific non-human characters, a bird, a fish, and an eel.
No human narrator, no David Attenborough figure guiding us.
None at all. You're dropped right in. The aim is to make you experience the world through their senses, or at least Carson's scientifically informed imagination of their senses.
I'm trying to make you feel things like the pull of the tide, or maybe the way a fish detects tiny vibrations from a predator.
Exactly. Or the scent of distant spawning grounds carried on an ocean current. It's about sensory immersion.
And the structure, it takes us on this journey through different zones of the ocean, right? In three parts.
Correct. Part one is called Edge of the Sea. That focuses right on the shoreline, the tidal flats, the marshes. That dynamic, often harsh zone where the land and water meet.
Constantly changing. Constantly. Then part two, The Gull's Way, takes us offshore, into the open ocean, over the continental shelf. This vast three-dimensional world. It looks uniform from a boat, maybe, but underneath?
It's teeming with life. Complex food webs.
Precisely. Huge schools of fish moving through the currents. And finally, part three is River and Sea.
And this one traces, I think you called it, the most mythic journey.
It really feels that way. It connects the absolute depths of the mid-ocean all the way back to inland freshwater streams, following the life cycle of the eel.
Wow. So across these three parts, what are the big ideas Carson keeps coming back to?
It really drills down into the fundamental forces governing life in the sea. Things like the relentless cycle of life and death, birth, reproduction,
Okay.
the incredible journeys of migration, the constant, inescapable predator-prey relationships,
Survival.
survival, and overarching all of that is the sheer power of instinct. Instinct tied to the seasons, to the phases of the moon, to the ocean currents themselves.
She really wants us to stop just describing the ocean and start feeling its rhythms, its power.
That's the goal, to feel its gravity.
Okay, let's dive into part one then. Edge of the Sea. Our guide here is Ran the Sanderling.
Yes, Ran. And he perfectly embodies life in that littoral zone, that edge world. His life is just constant motion, constant vigilance.
You picture those little birds skittering along the edge of the waves, right?
Exactly. Carson paints this vivid picture of him frantically feeding, probing the wet sand for tiny shrimp and clams as the tide goes out, always just ahead of the water. His entire world is dictated by the tide's rhythm.
And his story isn't just about one beach. Carson uses him to show interconnectedness.
Right. This tiny bird undertakes these huge migrations, flying thousands of miles from Arctic breeding grounds all the way down to southern beaches for the winter and then back again.
Linking these vastly different ecosystems through his one small life.
And the dangers are immediate, visceral. Carson describes, for instance, the sudden, terrifying attack of a peregrine falcon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, forcing Ran into this split-second life-or-death aerial maneuver. It really highlights that survival is about constant awareness, reacting instantly.
It's not just predators either, is it? She also emphasizes the sheer power of nature itself.
Definitely. There's a powerful description of an autumn storm hitting the coast. It's this immense, impersonal force. The birds can't fight it. They can't outsmart
They'd
it.
have to endure it.
They just have to endure. Survival becomes about resilience, hunkering down, waiting it out, until that deep instinct kicks in again, that irresistible urge telling Ran it's time for the long flight north.
That relentless drive, which sort of leads us out from the edge into the open water with our next guide, Scomber the Mackerel.
Yes, Scomber takes us into part two, the Gull's Way. This is the pelagic zone, the world of the open ocean. And his story begins right at the source, the massive spawning events.
Almost unimaginable numbers.
Millions upon millions of eggs released into the water column, a numbers game from the very start.
And through Scomber's life, Carson shows us this hidden world, what she calls the pasture of the sea.
It's a beautiful phrase, isn't it? She details the food chain. It starts with microscopic plants, the phytoplankton, diatoms,
The base layer.
the base layer. They get eaten by tiny animals, zooplankton, copepods mostly. And then Scomber eats them, filtering huge amounts of water.
So Scomber is constantly moving, constantly feeding.
Pretty much driven by hunger, moving in these enormous schools, often within the great ocean currents, like the Gulf Stream, which acts like a river within the sea.
And he's not just a predator, he's also a prey, right?
Oh, absolutely. He's eating smaller things, but he's a vital food source for bigger fish like tuna and dolphins, sharks, and of course for humans. The fishing fleets targeting the shoals are ever present. He's a crucial link in that chain.
What really struck me reading this part was the sheer scale of life and death. It's almost impersonal.
It is. You have millions of eggs, millions of larvae, but only a tiny, tiny fraction survive to adulthood. The individual mackerel's fate.
Yeah.
Almost irrelevant.
It's all about the survival of the species, statistically speaking.
Exactly. It's a stark, unsentimental look at the realities of ocean life. It's not cruel, it just is.
Which then sets up the final, perhaps most epic journey, Anguilla the Eel in part three, River and Sea.
If Ran's journey was long, Anguilla's is, well, it's mind-boggling. It spans the entire Atlantic basin practically. It's a story about deep time, genetic memory, incredible endurance.
Where does it even begin? It sounds so mysterious.
It begins in maybe the most mysterious place in the Atlantic, the Sargasso Sea. That calm, weedy area in the middle of the gyre.
Okay.
Down in the dark depths, all the mature eels from both Europe and North America somehow converge. They spawn, release their eggs, and then they die. It's a one-way trip for the adults.
Wow, a final instinct-driven pilgrimage.
For millennia. And then we follow Anguilla, one of those offspring. She starts as this tiny, transparent, leaf-shaped larva. It's called a leptocephalus.
Right.
And for about a year, she just drifts, carried passively by the Gulf Stream towards the
A
coast.
whole year just drifting.
A whole year. Then, as she nears the coast, a transformation happens. She changes shape, becoming a small, transparent eel called an elver. And she starts actively swimming into estuaries, the brackish water where rivers meet the sea.
And then the really incredible part begins, right? The upstream journey.
Yes. This tiny creature, driven by some powerful unknown impulse, starts fighting her way upstream, against the current, over obstacles, waterfalls sometimes.
Incredible determination.
Until she finds a suitable home. Maybe a quiet, muddy-bottomed pond, miles and miles inland. And there she might live for 10, maybe 20 years.
Connecting the deep sea directly to some small, ordinary-looking freshwater pond? That linkage is amazing.
It truly is. And then after a decade or more, the cycle prepares to complete.
That mysterious impulse returns.
It does. Her body undergoes another transformation. Her eyes enlarge, her skin changes color, preparing her for the deep sea again. And she begins the long, final journey back. Downstream, out to sea, across the ocean.
Back to the Sargasso Sea. To spawn and die where she began.
Completing the cycle. Ensuring the next generation. It's an astonishing story. And through it, Carson connects the abyssal plain, the open ocean, the estuary, the river, the pond. It all becomes one single, vast, interconnected system.
It really is a masterclass in teaching ecology without you ever feeling like you're, you know, being lectured at. So let's try and pull out some of the main themes that resonate from this.
Okay. I think the absolute foundational theme, the one that underpins everything she wrote later, is the interconnectedness of all life.
We saw that with Rand linking Arctic and tropics.
And the eel linking the deep sea and some random inland pond. The book paints the ocean, and really the planet, as one single vast living system where everything affects everything else.
And the implication for us today is pretty clear, isn't it?
Starkly clear.
Yeah.
Means that, you know, pollution we create locally on our beach, in our river, it doesn't just stay there. It ripples out. It affects the whole system.
Like pulling a thread in a tapestry.
Exactly. The whole thing feels it. That's a huge takeaway. Another key theme is her ability to offer a truly non-human perspective.
Right. You mentioned empathy earlier, but without making the animals seem like furry humans.
Precisely. It's not cheap anthropomorphism. She doesn't give Ran or Scomber human thoughts or feelings. Instead, she uses her deep scientific knowledge about their senses, how they detect pressure changes, smells, vibrations, to credibly imagine their reality, to build authentic empathy based on understanding their actual biological world.
Which forces a shift in us, the reader. We start to respect these creatures on their own terms, adapted to their world, not just as, like, characters in our human drama.
Yes. And tied to that is the third major theme, the primacy of instinct and natural rhythms.
That life in the sea isn't about conscious choices mostly.
Not in the way we think of it. It's governed by these incredibly powerful, ancient, innate drives, instincts tied to the changing seasons, the lunar cycles, the flow of currents. These are the real rulers of the sea.
It's actually quite humbling, isn't it? Realizing these vast migrations, these epic life and death struggles are playing out constantly, driven by instinct alone, largely unseen and unaffected by us.
Utterly humbling. The world has its own deep ancient dramas unfolding, completely separate from human concerns.
And Carson's skill is blending that science with such beautiful language. The book is full of lines that just stick with you.
Yeah, she had that ability to make science sound like poetry without sacrificing the accuracy.
Let's share a few key ideas or quotes. Here's one that really captures that experiential knowledge she valued.
To stand at the edge of the sea is to have knowledge of things that are as nearly eternal as any earthly life can be.
It suggests true understanding isn't just facts. It's about feeling that connection to something timeless, something bigger than yourself.
Great.
Through your senses.
Exactly. Then there's her quite blunt description of the food web, which importantly includes us.
The mackerel, like all the other fish of the schools, was a creature of the chains of life. A link in a chain that began in the very substance of the sea and ended, perhaps, on the table of a man.
No sentimentality there. It just places humans squarely within that natural system of consumption. We're part of the chain, not above it.
Yeah, just another link. And that final, simple, powerful line that echoes throughout the book.
For all at last return to the sea.
Capturing that immense cycle. The ocean is the origin, the sustainer, and ultimately the receiver of all life.
The great reservoir.
Okay, so bringing this back to us, listening now, how can we apply these ideas from a book written over 80 years ago? Especially if, you know, maybe we don't live near the ocean.
Well, I think the most crucial application is developing that sense of ecological empathy we talked about.
How does that help practically?
Because once you genuinely feel for the struggle of the sanderling trying to survive a storm, or the sheer tenacity of that eel larva drifting for a year, You're much more likely to care about things like plastic pollution or sustainable fishing practices, even if they seem far away.
It provides the emotional why.
Exactly. It's the bedrock for a real conservation ethic, not just an intellectual one. And related to that, the book is just a fantastic lesson in how to observe nature more deeply.
So it changes how you might look at your own surroundings.
Hopefully. After reading Carson, maybe a walk on a beach or even just along a riverbank becomes different. You start seeing the hidden stories. A tide pool isn't just a puddle. It's a complex little world. You see a migrating bird and wonder about its incredible map.
You start looking closer.
Yes, with more informed curiosity. And I think a third application is simply gaining humility and perspective.
Understanding our place.
Yeah. Recognizing the immense ancient scale of the ocean, the power of its rhythms, and our own relative smallness and recent arrival on the scene. It's a powerful antidote to human arrogance, isn't it?
It really is. Helps maybe reevaluate our own priorities sometimes.
Definitely.
You know what really surprised me revisiting this book for our deep dive was just how fully formed her vision was right from the start. She basically invented this genre of literary science writing, this blend of rigorous biology and beautiful prose, long before Silent Spring made her a household name. This book isn't just a warm-up act, it's the cornerstone.
I agree. And for me, the lasting insight, the paradigm shift it offers, is that move away from a purely human-centered universe.
Right.
Carson forces us to acknowledge that the world is just pulsing with these complex lives, these epic dramas that have absolutely nothing to do with us. They exist entirely on their own terms.
And real empathy comes from trying to understand that world.
Yes, that intimate, imaginative, scientifically grounded understanding of the non-human. That's where it starts.
So her ultimate message, still echoing today, is really before we jump to managing or fixing or even saving the natural world.
We first have to learn to truly see it, to understand it, and maybe most importantly, to feel that deep connection, that reverence for it, just as it is.
A profound foundation.
Indeed.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.